I'm Rick Antley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When author David Owen and his wife began having children, they moved from the big city, in this case Manhattan, to the suburbs. It was a choice many new families make, a desire to give their kids what they had growing up, a big house with a big yard. But in a brand new book called Conundrum, Owen says his move from city to country was an ecological disaster. Going from an apartment to a house meant his family's home energy use soared. It meant the purchase of many new possessions, like more furniture and appliances, to fill the extra rooms he now had. And it meant a lot more time in the car, getting from place to place. So while on the face of it, his lifestyle seemed more green, living close to the outdoors, trees, grass, and fresh air, in reality, he writes, the list of our environmental sins grew impressively. And that's just one of the many conundrums Owen examines in his new book. Over and over, he shows us how actions that make us think we're being earth-friendly, whether driving a hybrid car or eating locally, don't really help. In fact, he says they often turn out to have their own environmental hazards. The one step that he says would make a difference is the one most of us are unwilling or unable to do: live smaller, live closer, and drive less. Today in The Exchange, we contemplate the conundrum of what it really means to be green and why David Owen says so many of us are fooling ourselves. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. If you're dedicated to being green, how willing are you to do what Owen suggests? Move to a city? Give up your car? Do you agree or disagree with Owen that technologies like hybrid cars are not the real answer to our environmental problems? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And David Owen joins us from his home in Connecticut. And David, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you, Laura.
Well, the message you hammer away at, David, in this book again and again is it's not about the technology, folks. It's not about hybrid cars. It's not about windmills. It's not about complex fluorescent light bulbs. It's not about energy efficient buildings. None of this is going to help. And I have to say, David, even though I understand some of the things you're saying, really not at all, not an iota. It doesn't help if I, you know, winterize my house and don't use as much oil to heat it.
Well, I do all these things in my own house. I've gone around with my foam gun trying to find gaps. I've got a 200-year-old house, and we might as well just put the furnace in the yard for all the insulation that we have in it. And yet, if you draw your focus back from your own consumption, from your own uses, and look at the global economy and at the history of civilization, you see that all of civilization is the story of ever-increasing efficiency, of getting more from less fuel, of getting more from less material. And yet that has not caused us overall to use less, either individually or as a species. We've used it to leverage our consumption. As we get better at doing things, we do more things.
It's kind of like low-fat ice cream. You can eat twice as much.
Right. Well, there are all kinds of... It's my book, I think, is really about unintended consequences and how we have lots of ways of avoiding the real question, which has to do with less. How do we do less? And most of us in our society don't like to think of things that way. I had a conversation with someone who said, you know, skip all the arguments. You know, just tell me what to buy. You know, should I have a different car? I'll buy a different car. And that's we tend to think in terms of product substitution. But when you're talking about when consumption itself is the issue, when it's too much water, too much fuel, too much pollution, too much carbon. We have lots of ways of avoiding the core question, which is how do we do less?
So product substitution is not the answer. Does that mean I can, you know, get rid of my hybrid and buy a Hummer?
Well, I think you're always going to do what is best for you, what your circumstances compel you to do. The question is whether what you do with what if I save fuel. If I save money by fueling my house, what do I do with that money? I don't take it out and put it on the compost heap. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to use it for something. Maybe I'll fly to halfway around the world. I think we assume that if we've, it's in the book I call it the Prius fallacy, which is that the idea that switching to an ostensibly more benign form of consumption turns consumption itself into an environmental positive. There was a Prius commercial a couple of years ago in which there's this colorless landscape. It's been all the life has been drained out of it. And then a Prius drives across it. A hybrid automobile drives across it. And as the Prius passes, all the landscape bursts into color. Children with butterfly wings, you know, hover above children who look like flowers. And music plays and there are rainbows in the background. And the feeling, which definitely trying to convey, is that, you know, by driving this car, you're doing something positive. It's driving into an environmental benefit. We're doing something, we're sort of vacuuming bad things from the world just by driving around.
Well, most people would recognize, okay, yes, if I drive a Prius, I'm not, you know, sucking up carbon dioxide and turning the earth green. That commercial is a little silly.
But a little over the top.
Yeah, but most people listening, David, would say, okay, but I've got to drive to work. Right. Isn't it better that I drive a Prius than drive, you know, a giant SUV or something?
Bobby, in the narrow view, looking at ourselves, yes. As you pull your view back and you look at the total problem, global consumption, the world's energy meter, it keeps rising. And in a way, we cause it to rise by accommodating by doing these very things. We help it rise by making energy less expensive for ourselves, which is what we're doing. You know, I think there are lots of environmentalists who would say energy is too cheap for Americans. You know, Europeans pay at least twice what we do for gasoline. And people will say, well, that's crazy. Energy is too cheap in the United States and always has been, and that's why we use so much of it. But if you think about what you do when you switch to an automobile that gets twice as many miles to the gallon, what you've really done is cut your fuel cost in half. And although it doesn't immediately lead to cause you to drive more than you did before or cause your fuel expenditure to rise, in the long run, over the entire human population, that's the very effect it has. By constantly, as we make our machines more efficient, we use them more. We find more uses for them.
Well, I got to say, and I don't have a hybrid, but if I did have one, I don't think I would drive any more or any less. I still have to go to the grocery store. I still occasionally have to go, you know, visit friends and family around the state. I don't think saving money on gas would make me drive any more or any less.
No, of course. And it's when you look at the end use, that's true. So I have a more efficient furnace. I don't heat my house to 100
That's
degrees.
That's right, right.
But we do. If you take a longer view, for example, look at houses. I don't heat my house to 100 degrees, but the average house in the United States is twice the size that it was when I was a kid in the 1950s, even though the size of the average American family has shrunk. That means that the total space available to heat has doubled. And we actually heat more than double because people didn't heat their houses to the extent that they do now.
So we can heat our houses with more efficient home heating systems, but our houses are twice as big.
They're twice as big.
I see what you're saying.
As air conditioners, as we become more efficient in these technologies, we drive down the cost of those technologies. In the 1950s, hardly any houses in the United States had air conditioning of any kind, even a room air conditioner. Today, it's something like 85% of American dwellings are air-conditioned, and most of that is central. We gradually, as we get better at doing things, we do more things, and we have lots of different ways of not confronting that fundamental issue. It's easy to make ourselves feel better. It's much harder to have an overall long-term global impact on all these issues.
Our phone number here in the Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us today in the Exchange. Our guest is David Owen, staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book we're talking about, The Conundrum, How Scientific Innovation, Increased Efficiency, and Good Intentions Can Make Our Energy and Climate Problems Worse. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. And you talk a lot about climate and carbon footprint in this book, David, and you say if you want to find the city or the place in America where people have the smallest carbon footprint, look no further than the Big Apple. Wow. A lot of people don't think of New York as a green nirvana.
No, quite the opposite. People tend to look at New York City and they see all of our environmental problems condensed into a single spot. It looks like environmental hell. It's all concrete and diesel fumes and traffic jams, and it looks like an ecological nightmare. But in fact, city dwellers have small energy footprints. They live in small spaces. They use public transportation, something that the rest of us don't do. They're less likely to drive automobiles. In the United States as a whole, we have 50 million more registered automobiles than we have licensed drivers. The average family has, I can't remember, North Dakota, I think it is, 15% of families have five or more passenger vehicles. We have more cars than anybody in the world. In New York City, in Manhattan, 77% of households don't own even one car. When we talk about public transit, for example, the desirability of public transit, what we're really talking about is moving people and their destinations close enough together to make public transit work. Transit just doesn't work in a suburb. It doesn't work where I live. It doesn't work in places where people live spread out. Manhattan, New York City contains half of all the subway stops in the United States.
Wow.
The New York metropolitan New York area accounts for almost a third of all the public transit passenger miles.
But David, and sorry to jump in on you here, not everybody wants to live in New York City, myself included.
No, me too. My wife and I moved away from it. But the question, I think this is a fun question. People say, I want to do something good for the environment. And you say, well, here's how you make, we need more public transit. And you say, well, here's what makes public transit work. Say, oh, well, I don't want that. I don't want to live like that. That's where we sort of stop and say, that's considered to be a sufficient rebuttal of an observation about the environment. Well, that's not what I want.
Well, and David, we'll talk more after a short break. Again, the book is The Conundrum, How Scientific Innovation, Increased Efficiency, and Good Intentions Can Make Our Energy and Climate Problems Worse. We'll start taking your calls, too, after a short break. 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network organizations hosting Destination College, a college planning convention for high school juniors and parents in March. Information at destinationcollege.org. And Service Credit Union, meeting the financial needs of New Hampshire businesses with professional advisors and custom solutions. Learn more online at servicecu.org/business. More on a new environmental conundrum on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, Politics, Planned Parenthood, and Women's Health Care. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny. Highs today from 30 in the North Country, 40 in central sections of the state, and 40 to 45 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around zero in the North Country, 15 in central parts of the state, 15 to 20 degrees in southern New Hampshire. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs from 35 to 40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new book examines what it calls the conundrum when it comes to what it really means to be green. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest is David Owen. He's the author and a staff writer for The New Yorker. If you're dedicated to living a green lifestyle, how willing are you to do what Owen suggests? Move to a more compact area, a city perhaps, and give up your car? Do you agree or disagree with Owen that technologies, even supposedly earth-friendly inventions, are not the real answer to our environmental problems? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And David, here's an email that just came in from Matt in Deerfield. He says, my wife and I went from comparatively greener living in Ithaca, New York, where we had only one car with short commutes and frequent use of public transit. Now I live in Deerfield and we commute to Windham and Concord in a house instead of an apartment. But, Matt says, we also use our land size to raise chickens and grow gardens, providing ourselves with steadily more food. I'd just like to ask your guest how he thinks these alternatives tend to balance out. Thanks for that email, Matt in Deerfield. And go ahead, David, what do you think?
Well, there's a powerful appeal to growing our own food. It feels like doing something concrete to address these problems.
By the way, those commutes that he mentioned are relatively long.
My wife and I discovered this too. You know, when we lived in the city, we thought living in the country, wow, we imagined, you know, long walks in the woods and kayaking and you know, gathering eggs from our own chickens. But what you really do when you move to the country is you move into a car because there's no place that, no destination that you can walk to. You know, my dentist is two towns away. And when we lived in the city, our pediatrician was in the lobby of our apartment building, just an elevator a ride away. So the you know, dense cities, urban cores, are really the last places in the United States, other than maybe college campuses, where walking is still a primary form of transportation, where you can conceivably live without a car, without really making your life difficult.
But here's Matt, and he says, okay, Matt, yeah. I hear you. I feel bad about the commutes that I'm making. But he says, at least I'm trying to grow my own food and, you know, raise my own hens and eggs and so forth. So, you know, what's the balance there?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I just have contrarian views about everything. But on food is more difficult than we make it out to be. And the comical example I use is a New Yorker colleague of mine who raises her own chickens. And it's a surprisingly popular activity, the idea, well, I will raise chickens, I will get eggs from my own yard. But she drives individual hens to the veterinarian, and that fact alone gives her eggs a significant carbon footprint. Backyard farmers tend not to be the most efficient farmers. They tend to use more water, use more fertilizer, they generate more waste. They are not as efficient at harvesting their crops. You end up, this is the zucchini problem, the driving around the neighborhood looking desperately for people who will take your watermelon-sized zucchinis or the tomatoes that you can't eat yourself. That's waste in the same way that driving is. It's very hard to do those things. The fact that you just have to walk into your backyard to get it is not the most important thing. In fact, of all the
energy... Can we talk about that? Because sure. Local inorganic produce is a cherished idea for many here in New Hampshire, and we've got a fair bit of our population who is dedicated to eating local and eating organic. But here you are saying, nah, you know, do it if you want to, but don't pat yourself on the back for being a good environmentalist.
I live in an agricultural area, too, and I love local food. There's an orchard here that's been here since the time of the American Revolution. But of all the energy expended in the production and processing of food, transportation, the food mile represents the smallest share. Among the very largest is home preparation, which actually accounts for a quarter of the total. There's a terrific book by somebody other than me called Just Food by James McWilliams.
We've had him on this program, yes.
He's great, and he's a lapsed locavore, as he calls himself. And he has written that we'd be better off focusing on what happens to our food after we buy it than on its place of origin. Because home preparation accounts for a quarter of the total. Home canning is an environmentally disastrous thing to do. All that heat that is inefficiently disappearing, all the energy that you're consuming when you heat those berries that you've taken from your yard.
So the dreaded food miles that are so often criticized, you know, why are you buying green beans from Guatemala when you could buy them from your local farmer? You're saying it's not really about the fact that it came from Guatemala,
It's not the miles. It's not the miles. It's how it was grown, what was put on it while it was growing, how it was watered, how much water it was. Food is such an emotional issue. It's hard to talk about these things. So I think that one way to see this is to think about a non-food agricultural product like cotton. Many people will tell us we should be wearing more natural fibers because synthetic fibers are made from fossil fuels. But I don't think anyone would argue that it would make sense for people in New Hampshire to wear cotton clothing only made of cotton that was grown within 25 or 50 or 100 miles of where they live, because you can see that growing agricultural items in places that are not suited to their cultivation is not an environmental gain. It requires more land. It requires many more inputs. It requires more energy. I think that everybody would like for all these questions to be simple, but they're not. And the arithmetic on some of them is surprising. It's more complicated than we want it to be. One example is that grass-fed lamb imported to London from New Zealand has a quarter of the energy footprint of grain-fed lamb raised locally in England.
And why is that?
It's because of the way it was raised, and because of the fact, as McWilliams points out, that the energy expended in transporting that food from halfway around the world per pound, per unit of food, is tiny. It's very small. You do much. When my wife and I drove, two towns away to pick raspberries, we gave those raspberries a staggering carbon footprint, much more than the raspberries we buy at the grocery store from California, because the raspberries we brought home, it was my wife and me in our car, plus our raspberries. They didn't come across the country on a train.
Well, let's invite some more listeners to our conversation. Again, David, 1-800-892-6477. The author is David Owen. The book is called The Conundrum. And let's go to Middlebury, Vermont, where Krista is waiting. Hi, Krista. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call. I am extremely interested in this perspective. I run an online weight management program. We have 198 million Americans overweight. Or obese in this country, and it's really about behavior change. And I would just like to hear his comments. It sounds to me like what we really need is a really straightforward, radical behavior change policy.
Well, and Krista, you live in Middlebury, a walkable town. So what do you suggest for people who, you know, live far out because they can't afford to live in a nice city center like Middlebury?
I think it's very, I do live right in the village, and I did live outside of the village, having come from a city, and after 4 years, I made the decision to move in. So it is difficult financially because in-town living is highly prized and more expensive, and yet it's made a tremendous difference in terms of our health and how much we walk. So I'm a big believer in what Vermont's trying to do is create sustainable village centers and town centers. Because I think that the amount of driving you do back and forth to take your kids back to school is just—it's incredibly bad for the environment,
okay.
and it's bad for people sitting on their bus gaining weight.
Well, and Krista, David Owen says in the book when he and his wife moved from city to suburbs, they each gained 10 pounds.
Right,
so
the first thing,
there
yeah.
you have that. but talk about what she says about sustainable communities, because you say in the book some of these have worked very well and others have basically fallen flat.
Well, first I want to agree with what she said about behavior. We want this to be a technological problem. But, you know, scientists will invent something that will make this all go away. But it is a behavior problem. And behavior is tougher because, it's us. We really already know how to solve most of these problems. We just don't like the answers. And so that is the conundrum right there.
And the answer, again, is live smaller, live closer, drive less.
Well, yeah, to consume less. To shrink our footprint, not to just swap one product for another. She's right about what she says about compact communities, and in this country, unfortunately, almost all the incentives push in the other direction. Land use laws tend to stipulate minimum distances between places rather than maximum. So you have to have a setback between your house and another. We tend to require minimum number of parking places rather than maximum, which is why we have these seas of redundant asphalt spaces that are empty much of the time, just because we've built parking lots that are intended to hold the maximum number of cars that could ever arrive there. And when we do things like that, when we spread things out, we not only just, pour more asphalt on the ground, we also increase the distance between us and wherever we're going. We make cars more important to our lives. We become ever more dependent on them. And then simultaneously, this is this other way that it comes around and bites us in the rear end, we have made our cars extraordinarily comfortable. My car is a very pleasant place to be. I think I think people find when they live outside of cities that the way you have a conversation with your child is in a car. It's like a living room, and the famous NPR moment. Everybody's familiar with this. You're in your car going someplace. You're listening to something. You want to keep listening to it. You drive around while it finishes. I was driving on the highway not long ago and looked through the rear window of the car in front of me, and there were two DVD players, and the two children in the back seat were watching different movies. We've made our cars extraordinarily comfortable to ourselves, and as a result, we're willing to commute longer distances. We're willing to spend more time driving around in those cars. We're willing to drive much farther in our daily activities than anybody conceivably would have been at an earlier point in our history.
You know, you also mention driving less, and that's a theme that keeps coming up in this book and in our conversation with listeners. But you also say in the book, you know, high-speed rail, not necessarily. You're not necessarily a 100% fan of trains. Why not, David? What's the conundrum about trains?
The conundrum about trains is this is typical of the way we tend to think about these problems. This is the Prius fallacy again. The idea, we have the idea, okay, trains are more efficient than planes. Therefore, train travel is good. But if all we're doing is adding another form of mobility, we're making our problem worse, not making it better. If the only way to get from New York City to California was by train, yes, that would be good. But it would be great for the environment because the main impact would be that people would decide, the hell with that, I'm not going to California. I'm not going to spend a week getting to a place where I have a meeting for a day. The conundrum is that when we think about these things, we're really thinking about making the idea that trains will make travel easier, cheaper, more pleasant, just the way we have with our cars. We're not as willing to talk about reducing mobility itself.
But isn't it better, David, to jump on a train than jump in my car?
It's better to jump in your car too, rather than to It's better to pave an interstate highway system, which makes it you use less fuel to get to your distant destination, if you look only at that. But if you think, what does this do to driving in general? Well, it makes me want to move around more. And we don't, when people talk about building high-speed rail, they're not talking about bulldozing a compensating number of highway lanes. This will be added to our transportation infrastructure. We're not going to subtract anything from it that will force people onto those trains.
Well, let's take another call, David. Lots to look into, and let's take Carly in Hampton. Hi, Carly. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say that I think it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, economic class has a lot to do with this, and not everybody has the same choices as the author and I think many other folks. Well, I think a lot of people live where they live because that's where they can afford. And I know myself, I love cities. I would love to live in a city, but I cannot afford to live there. And also, I mean, if you look at a place like New York City, yes, there are folks who are living in Manhattan and have a great life. For many other folks in New York City, it's an environmental nightmare because they're living in substandard housing. You know, they have many health problems because of, you know, because of asthma and because of the environment that they live in. And I just think it's, you know, really important to keep in mind that, you know, not everybody has the choice to say, okay, well, I love living in the suburbs or in the country, my huge house, but I'm going to make the choice to live in the city. You know, a lot of people live in the suburbs, in the country, in tiny places, in apartments, and, you know, they live where they live because that's what they can afford. And I just think it's really important to that in mind.
Carly, thanks a lot for calling in. And, you know, she's right, David. In some New Hampshire cities, it's a lot more expensive to live in town. In Hanover, where Dartmouth College is, for example, real estate's very expensive. I'm guessing the people who serve the meals and clean the bathrooms at Dartmouth probably don't live in that lovely downtown. So, you know, Carla's saying, hey, look, they don't have another choice.
Oh, yeah. I don't get me wrong. There's millions of downsides to urban living.
Yeah, the dirty air.
My wife and I fled for economic reasons. Mm-hmm. We had a child. There was no way we could afford to live in New York City. I think these are the issues. I think when you look at a city, the real environmental issues, or when you look at compact living, the main environmental issues tend to be things like education, quality and affordability of education, noise, you know, the extraordinarily loud garbage trucks in the streets of New York, crime, things like that. What I'm saying is that if we want to do things like if you want to truly shrink human energy and carbon footprints, the only way to do it is to pull people and their destinations closer together. And it's difficult because, as she says, it's expensive. What we tend not to see is how expensive it is to live in this other way, to live spread out. Because we sort of hide the cost to ourselves. One of the costs is the road network that supports us when we live far away from the centers. There's that road that you have to follow into town. You pay for it. You just don't pay for it out of your pocket today. You have to pay for the power lines that come to your house. You have to pay for the sewer lines and the gas lines and everything that comes, all the infrastructure that supports you as you live farther and farther away from other people. A car is extraordinarily expensive. But my daughter lives in Manhattan. When she first moved there, when she first moved to New York, she lived in Brooklyn, and she wanted a car. And I said, you know, do the arithmetic on a car sometime. You pay a lot for an apartment, but you would pay more living in a cheap apartment for a car. It's an extraordinary luxury to be able to walk to where you go. And I think she's found that. And that's, we're not as good at factoring all those things in.
Looking at the total overall cost.
The way you live, when you can walk to the grocery store, that's worth something. That's why that house in town is more expensive.
Well, here's an email from Jonathan, kind of taking the other side of what our caller Carly just said from Hampton. And thanks, Carly, for the call. Jonathan says, Laura, you said you need to drive your car to work into the store, but you don't. Jonathan, you misheard me. I don't drive my car to work. I do drive to the grocery store. You can move to a compact urban center, a city. My girlfriend and I did just that when we left green rural Vermont and moved to in-town Portland, Maine. We now do all our daily chores, including shopping and work, by walking and cycling. You have made the choice to live in a place where you need a car. You can make a different choice anytime you like. So that's what Jonathan is saying. Carly is saying, not quite so simple.
Well, they're both right, but these choices are not. We can't just instantly move ourselves to different places most of the time.
Especially with the housing market today.
Selling a house right now. In addition, people don't just walk away from their whole lives, from where their children grew up, from where their children go to school, from where their friends are. We're not perfectly mobile because of who we are. And in addition, we're not just going to bulldoze metropolitan Atlanta and, you know, replace it with something that makes more sense from an environmental point of view. We've done this thing, and we live with it. But I think what we can do is that as the United States looks at population growth ahead, is to think about adjusting the incentive so that we encourage that growth to take place in ways that are less damaging.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. Thank you for all those emails and calls. Keep them coming at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
NHPR produces lots of local programming, word of mouth, The Exchange, The Folk Show, and news reports. But you might not realize that NHPR has been cultivating a national reputation. Abby Goldstein is our vice president of programming.
Our reporters are heard frequently on the national network. And our primary night coverage from 8 to 10 p.m. was carried by 13 stations across the country.
So not only do we bring you the news of the nation, but we also bring the nation the news of New Hampshire. Now you know.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Cambridge Trust Company of New Hampshire, building lasting relationships and providing thoughtful, independent investment, trust, and wealth management services. CambridgeTrust.com. And the Music Hall in Portsmouth, presenting the Soweto Gospel Choir, performing tribal, traditional, and African and Western gospel, February 13th at 7 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the melee over medical marijuana in the Granite State. Should New Hampshire approve its use, like Vermont and Maine have? Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, David Owen is here, the author of a new book called Conundrum. It talks about the many myths of going green. 1-800-892-6477 is the number, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Well, David, we've tilted a lot of windmills when it comes to the environment, local food, city versus country, hybrid cars, high-speed trains. But let's talk about alternative energy. The favored ones that most environmentalists support are solar and wind, called clean, everlasting, completely renewable. Why are those part of the problem?
Well, they're part of the problem because they haven't really. One reason is that they haven't, to any great extent, become part of the solution. Almost a quarter century since Bill McKibben wrote The Fate of the Earth, and yet the proportion of global energy consumption that's supplied by solar and wind is minuscule. It's minute. It's tiny. There was a headline in the Wall Street Journal today that is, oil and gas boom lifts U.S. economy. With a little tweaking, that headline really could have run on the front page of the Wall Street Journal every day since the journal was founded in the 1870s. We talk about these things, but we haven't really, to any extent, implemented them. And because we don't really want to. In addition, I think one of the reasons when people look at a place like New York City, where people live very compactly with very low energy consumption, they say, "Well, where can we put solar panels?" One difficulty with solar is that when it works the best, it requires lots of space. So if you're going to have a rooftop solar installation, really the ideal place to have it is you want a house on a big piece of property that's treeless in a place where the sun shines lots of the time. There are reasons that we haven't made anything like a real transformation to renewable sources. Most of the so-called renewable energy that's generated in the United States is generated by burning things.
So are solar and wind part of the conundrum or not?
Well, they are. Everything is part of the conundrum. we know how to generate electricity from solar and wind, but we don't know how to support the way we live right now on solar and wind. Solar and wind are tricky because they're intermittent resources. Lots of sunlight falls on the earth. There's lots of energy in the wind that blows around the earth, but it's just widely dispersed. It takes a lot of space to capture significant amounts of those. You would be very unhappy if you had an electric car that you had to charge only with solar panels.
Or wind power.
You would not be driving very much.
Well, so what's the answer, David? I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, we're not supposed to burn fossil fuels, wind and solar. You're kind of saying they've got their problems. Nuclear is very controversial, although it seems to be on the upswing here. Hydro's got its controversies. Biomass has its controversies. What's the answer?
Well, yeah. What's the simple answer to all these things? I think the fundamental question is, if we care about these issues, is are we willing, as a species, to leave some very large fraction of the world's remaining fossil fuels in the ground forever? And I don't think we've shown that. We have lots of ways of sort of kidding ourselves, and I think the most recent one is the current boom in natural gas, which has been treated as an environmental positive. You know, natural gas has been rebranded as the good fossil fuel. It's burning because burning it emits less carbon and fewer other pollutants.
Right, clean natural gas. It's called
clean natural gas,
which is not entirely clean, right?
It's been an extraordinarily successful rebranding of natural gas. It's like the other white meat. It's now the good fossil fuel. I heard I was at an environmental conference in Washington D.C. where one of the speakers said the natural gas was great for the environment. So once again, this is the Prius fallacy: the idea that this thing that is better in some ways is actually a positive. As we burn it, we're doing something good. But there are is a tremendous downside. There's more of these unintended consequences. One is that in the past, one of the greatest difficulties with getting any kind of traction with wind or solar was that it had to compete with coal, which is very cheap. Well, now it has to also compete with natural gas, which is extraordinarily cheap. So cheap that right now it's not even necessarily worth extracting from some of the places that we could extract it because the price is so low. Natural gas has another downside, which is that, for example, the oil sands in Alberta, the famous source of petroleum that is at the other end of the Keystone Pipeline that has been at least put on hold, it's very expensive and difficult to extract petroleum from the oil sands. It's much easier, much less expensive if you have a ready source of cheap natural gas because you have to burn a lot of gas to produce that oil. So there are all these sort of spiraling consequences and unintended consequences that kind of are constantly pushing us farther away from these solutions, even as we think we're doing something positive about these problems, assuming that we think that those problems are real.
Six more calls, David. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Greg's calling in from Brattleboro, Vermont. Hi, Greg. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. My observation is this. I'm looking at the economy, and like a lot of people, I've gone through a divorce, I've had to downsize, I had to really go through my my stuff and take inventory. There's a lot of people like me as I kind of extrapolate that out over the country. And I see that this economy, we're in the long haul here. It's not just going to be a blip. So I think economic necessity is going to really, that's what's going to cause a lot of these changes, because people will have to cluster. People will have to use public transportation, have to bike. It's a lot of what I see really post-war England, like my mum's generation, same kind of thing. So it's just going to occur mostly, that's what's going to change behaviors more than people making conscious decisions or technology breakthroughs, economics.
You know, Greg, I'm glad you called because, David, you do mention this in the book. You say in economic downturns, citizens behave like, you know, citizens behave like, what do you call it, model members of the Natural Resources Defense Council or something like that. You know, people get environmental when they don't have a lot of money or they're afraid they'll lose their jobs.
Well, it's not so much that they get green, it's that they do by necessity, as the caller says. In 2008, the world global carbon output energy consumption actually fell by a significant amount, which is something that not even, you know, the most wild-eyed environmentalist had anticipated. But the reason wasn't that the world had suddenly attained this green consciousness. It was that price of oil had soared and the global economy had imploded. And both of those things had the effect of causing people to use less. When gas gets expensive, people drive less. When oil is expensive, they turn down the, you know, in New Hampshire, they turn down the thermostat in their house. They don't heat it as warm as they did before. When people lose their jobs, they drive less. They cut back in all kinds of ways. Even wealthy people cut back.
But recessions are also painful, and you say that in the book. I mean, you don't want to get those environmental benefits and yet watch people truly suffer.
No, you don't. And that's the, I think that's the there's the another conundrum, which is how do we exploit the environmental benefits of reduced growth without the human suffering. And it's hard enough in the United States. If you extend that problem to the world, it's staggering. There are large parts of the human population that should be consuming much more energy just to bring them up to a minimal level that we would identify even as poverty. At the same time, you know, we clearly can't forever continue to consume this sort of grotesque proportion of the world's resources that we've gotten accustomed to consuming.
Well, and David, we've talked so much about this conundrum and that conundrum when it comes to all these different environmental options, if I could put it that way. You do give some solutions in the book. One of the big ones, and you touched on it before, is make energy cost more, and then we will just use less. That's a huge solution for you. How do you get around the fact, though, that poor people who are already struggling are just going to struggle even more by this? They live farther from work. They often drive less fuel-efficient cars. They can't afford that weatherization project to make the house more efficient. So, you know, it's one thing to say, let's do this for the environment, but then there's a real human cost to raising energy prices.
Exactly. That's the problem right there. How do you, I think there's some ways people talk about them of how you can do it. You can do it in a progressive way where what you're doing is making energy more expensive for the big consumers and less expensive for the people at the margin or below the margin, below the line. I think that, you know, all these issues remain entirely hypothetical because the idea that there's any will either as a people or the people that we elect to represent us, it just doesn't exist. When we have found ourselves in situations where serendipitously our price of energy has risen, we've put all our effort into pushing it the other way. You know, let's release oil from the National Strategic Reserve. Let's stop collecting taxes in the states on gasoline. Let's let's give incentives to people to drive more, to buy new cars. It's not the way we think, and I don't think we're likely to think that way. But it would be you know, economics is this powerful tool. It's really the only lever that's big enough to move the world. But we definitely do not know how to use it uniformly across the whole world in ways that don't just destroy people who even now are live at implausibly low levels of of affluence.
Here's an email from Brett who says, please have your guests comment on the fact that the most efficient way to minimize your footprint is to minimize your procreation. Bill McKibben wrote a book about that, too. I think it was called Just One.
Yes. Population is clearly it's a people problem, and you can look at almost any, when you think about any environmental solution, any environmental strategy, the first test, multiply it by 330 million, by 300 million, the population of the United States, multiply it by 7 billion, the population of the world, and see if it makes sense. There's the population is a huge issue. It's clearly, you know, all our problems are made worse by the fact that we multiply them by a steadily bigger number.
Well, and China tried that, the one-child policy. But aren't they moving away from that now? They've found it's created other problems.
It's interesting. The one part of China that has succeeded in one child per family is the only part of China that didn't have a one-child per family policy, which is Hong Kong. And there it's affluence and dense living, urban living, tend to have, as education increases, the birth rate falls. As affluence rises, the birth rate tends to fall globally. But it's that too is a complicated problem. In the United States, it doesn't matter. You know, Americans use more of everything than anyone. We account for this huge fraction of global consumption of everything.
So even those of us who, you know, even people who have no children are still accounting for a lot more than your average, you know, family in another country that has three kids.
Well, it's also that. So it's, I think some individuals have a bigger impact than other individuals. But this is a topic. This is an explosive topic because it has religious consequences.
Sure.
I mean, it has religious implications for some people. It's an immigration question too, because population increases both naturally through birth and also by people moving from country to country. An American has a big impact no matter how he or she originated.
Let's try and take one more if we could. This is Steve in Nottingham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Dave. A couple of thoughts. Number one is that I applaud the fact you're calling us from home rather than schlepping up to New Hampshire, which we'd prefer you do, because we would actually like to have you spend money in the state. But it does keep your carbon footprint. I'm calling you from home where I am also working. I also live on a lake, so I don't have to drive the kayak. I want to agree with one of your comments that I think there's a song we could have based America on. We built this city on rock and roll. We built this country on cheap gas. So I think anything we do to lower the make the price of gas is going to be a great thing. What I really want to get to is my partner does drive a PS, and she does carpool and bike to work, so you don't have to always slam the Prius owners. But the big point I want to get to is that, in fact, getting people to do anything, whether you think it helps or not, makes a difference. If people buy in to recycling, to changing light bulbs, that makes them feel better and makes them feel part of the solution than the problem. And I don't like the idea of poo-pooing. Everything is a conundrum. Don't try anything. Move to the city. I think everyone can do something and make a difference.
Steve, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think about that sentiment, David?
Don't tell folks
to give up recycling.
I just want to point out that my solution to everything is not for people to move to the city. I certainly haven't done it myself. No, I think we have to do these. We do these things. I think that what I would counsel myself about and anyone about is that to not persuade oneself that simply by making these tiny adjustments in consumption patterns, we've actually done anything to address these tremendous global, permanent, ongoing problems. It's very easy to make yourself feel better about all these things. It's much harder to have anything like a real impact. One of the things I say in the book is probably that, in terms of individual action, the thing that one could do to have the biggest impact on carbon and energy is probably to become a vegetarian. It's something that I have not succeeded in doing myself.
Because of all the fuel that goes into feeding those animals.
Yes, and then all the emissions that come as a consequence and all those things. But it's the difficulty with climate and with global energy is that they're not really, you know, we're used to thinking every little bit helps, every vote counts. It's not really true in a problem like energy and climate. It's not enough for take the oil sands for as an example. It's not enough that we don't refine that oil in the United States. If it just goes to someplace else, or if it comes to the United States by a different route, we haven't solved the problem. The challenge is how do you take a resource like that and leave it untouched?
And that's something we don't know. And David, I just want to close out with an email from Betsy in Enfield and maybe get your quick thoughts. She says, we live in a small condo. I follow my husband from room to room, turning off lights, turning down the heat, checking for leaks or in the plastic around the windows and feeling pretty smug about it. Then Betsy says she drives 5 miles to town and passes businesses with the lights on, even though they're closed for the day. She says, so what difference do I actually make in the world? Why should I care? It seems futile. Can you quickly address that, David?
Well, I think that's the conundrum. How do we pull it all together in enough numbers to make it really make a difference? It's not enough, as she said. You don't want to be like someone just sort of sitting on your suitcase waiting for the flying saucers to come. everybody has to pull in the same direction, and yet we can't agree about even seemingly much simpler things that issues that seem as though they ought to be easy to solve with our great big brains. But they stump us.
Thank you very much for exciting our brains today, David, with this book. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you, Laura.
The book is called The Conundrum. The author is David Owen. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Karen Gold. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.